Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's December 21st, 2012. You're listening to the best poker cast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
That's a lot of twos and ones in that date, isn't it? December 21st, 2012. Hopefully we're alive when this airs.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, I just realized we probably didn't put as much effort into our final show ever as we should have. But then again, obviously, you know, our early adopters are going to listen to the show today, which is December 20th, so they'll actually hear it. But most of our listeners probably won't have the opportunity to hear it anyhow. So I guess we shouldn't feel too bad about just doing a normal show.
Yeah, our last show. And heading into the editing process after this show is a lot of pressure on me now to get it posted in time for you to hear it.
You got to raise a clock here.
That's right, for the rains fire on everybody.
And I guess we should also say that we're kidding here, folks, for the folks that haven't been following the Mayan calendar. Ante Up will be back next week, I guarantee you.
How foolish will we be, though, if it does end?
Yes, exactly.
We'll be, you know, suffering an eternity knowing that we promised we'd be back next week and we weren't. I don't ever want to have to live with that, so we may be back next week.
But, you know, hey, you know, we don't have to worry about it.
I know, but I'm thinking, you know, my soul
You might is, have to worry about it.
My but, soul is going to be worried about it for eternity now that I didn't actually get back to the Ante Up Nation the next week. I have to live with that guilt for eternity.
Well, speaking of living with guilt for eternity, yesterday we had the news that I think a lot of people were waiting for. Howard Leonard did settle his civil complaint with the Department of Justice, and very much was very similar to what Ray First did before, you know, giving up some bank accounts, turning over some property, paying a fine, and not ever working for another online site for the rest of his life. And you know, obviously I did the Fifth Street Radio last night, as I always do. I'm sorry, Wednesday night, as I always do. And predictably there was I don't want to say venom, that's the wrong word, but
vitriol.
Yeah, it was you know, the Grinch who stole Christmas. And I again, as I always have been apparently what I think most of our listeners would call, I'm the Grinch for somewhat defending this guy. But I'm interested what you think, and because obviously I've already talked about it on the air with someone else, but I'm happy to follow up your initial thoughts with my already practiced thoughts.
One of the things that I always find interesting with these types of settlements is, it looked to me like the DOJ wanted the 40-something million going into this thing, but then settled for two. So what are they saying by settling for two? That's the part I don't... And I never really understand these suits, and I never hear you never get the full details. But are you telling me that you think now that 40 million of it was acquired properly and only 2 million wasn't? I don't understand that whole settlement thing. I agree with him not being able to be in the business ever again. That's probably something they were trying to get, and they did, and some of the other stuff. But if you're saying that the 40-something million was ill-gotten gains, why is it okay to only give up two of it? And I'm not saying he needed to give it all up. Maybe he didn't need to give any of it if he had a better lawyer or whatever it was. I don't know. But just to say that, okay, we accept this. This is fine. 2 million's fine. You can keep the other 40. What are you telling the American public then? Or what are you telling him?
Yeah, and this was a pretty big bone of contention that we were chatting about on Fifth Street, and this is kind of what I said about it. Well, first of all, we have to remember that the Department of Justice doesn't lack for showmanship.
Right.
I think you'd agree, right?
Right.
You know, they're the ones that call this a Ponzi scheme, which I still don't think it is. Lots of other people don't think it is. So certainly when you do the they're about getting publicity for the work they're doing. And you get a lot more publicity by saying, hey, these three guys stole $42 million than you do from they stole $2 million, you know?
Yeah.
So I think there's part of it is there's some grandstanding there just to get the notoriety for the case. And the other thing I'll say, and I'm obviously not a lawyer, and I don't even play one on TV, and maybe some of our listeners who do have a legal background will write or call us next week and weigh in on this. But, at the end of the day, as something we've had on the past, say, I mean, the Department of Justice and the court here, they operate as a business, right?
Yeah.
They need to fund their investment. Hopefully make a little extra coin so they can fund more. And at the end of the day, I think what they got out of Rafe, what they got out of Howard, and I assume they're going to get something very similar out of Chris Ferguson when he settles, probably more than pays for this investigation. And, you know, that's a good day at the office for him.
No, and that's fine. And I agree with that. I agree that they need to sort of prove what they're doing is worthwhile and can be funded with their however they get their money or whatever. But it just seems odd to me that you're going for $42 million of money that you say all of it was ill-gotten, and yet
yeah,
you said
but
over
that's
two
the thing is I don't think they ever were going for that.
Well, they called it a $42 million lawsuit.
I know, but I think that was all showmanship. I really do. Okay. I don't think that they were ever expecting to get that full amount. And to be honest, to get that full amount, they'd have to go to trial to get that. Yeah. I mean, no one's going to settle for the full amount that they're asking.
No, of course
for,
not.
You know what I mean?
So, no, of course not. But
and
the
obviously, there's a lot more
was...
cost in the trial, and then if they lose the trial, then that's even more embarrassing. So, you know, I think there's lots of reasons not to go to that. I mean, I guess the other thing too is, and again, I'm just opining here. I have
right.
no inside information on this, but you know, it's possible that you know they determine that quite a bit of this $40 million was actually properly earned and not part of this, you know, whatever the charge, you know, at the end of the day. You know, because if you see the entire settlement too, I mean, he admits no wrongdoing, of course, like Rafe did. He also says that he was not aware that or that he believed that Foltill was operating as a legitimate business until he learned otherwise on April 15th, 2011. You know, again, I know people don't want to recognize this, but it is possible that some of this money that he and Chris and everybody else and Rafe and even Ray Bitar, for that matter, earned was legitimately earned, you know, before the company went off the rails. And you know, I know a lot of people like to say, well, since day one when they didn't segregate player funds, they were off the rails. Well, okay, we can agree to disagree on that. But there's a difference between that and then crossing over into outright fraud, which obviously happened at some point. And that's why, you know, Ray Bitar is still the guy that I think is the center of this whole thing. And that's the other thing, too, is that, you know, no one really knows Ray Bitar as much as Howard Lederer or Chris Ferguson and Ray First. But the government really is pinning its case on that, right?
Around him.
Because
yeah.
if they had any reason to charge these other folks with criminal charges, they certainly would. Why wouldn't they? And they didn't. And, you know, Ray Bitar is facing life in prison right now over this. Is the only one criminally charged in this. And that's the case I think is most important to them. You know, if they get 2, 3, 4, 5 million, whatever they get out of these three guys that pays for the investigation, and they get a nice conviction and, you know, send Ray Bitar to Alcatraz for the rest of his life, I think that's a successful, in their mind, a successful prosecution. I very well could be wrong because I'm not a lawyer.
No, that sounds about right. What comes to mind when there's a, and it's civil, obviously, so it wasn't criminal, the settlement here for Lederer. And what comes to mind to me, though, is you remember the scene in Godfather 2 when he's reading to the in front of the panel, the senators and everything, and he's like, you know, when you find that I'm innocent, I hope that you use the same vigor that you know use to besmirch my name. when you try to clear it, when you say I'm innocent. Obviously, he was guilty. We knew he was guilty because we were watching a mafia movie. But with Lederer, like you said, if some of this money was, in their minds, approved or acquired legally, they should have mentioned that somehow. And so that we, as a poker community, can also feel a little bit more whole. You know, like, oh, okay, so turns out that he really wasn't doing anything wrong for $40 million of it, and for $2 million of it, he took that money too late, and he should have not taken that money and should have given it back, or whatever it was. But instead, they just said, here's all the counts we have against him. He was running a Ponzi scheme, and now we've gotten $2 million and we've settled it. And it's like, okay, but you're not telling us why you only took two and why you only accepted two as a settlement. Is it because 40 of it was clear and it's okay? You know, and I think he would be looking for that too. And it just clearly wasn't mentioned in the story or in the settlement.
And it very well may come after the Batard charges are settled. I mean, you know, again, there's probably not a lot that they can say right now because they don't want to compromise that case. So I think you make a very good point, and I would say after the Batar case is settled, if there's not any fuller explanation at that point, I'm certainly on Team Cosenza here, demanding that kind of information.
And that's true too, because that also could compromise their case with Batar if they start releasing details of how this guy was innocent, how Lederer was innocent. You know, then Batar's lawyers could use that to build their case or something. So maybe that's why they're not keeping all of that information or public or whatever, so making it public. So, but one more peg in the process of settling this whole situation and moving on.
Well, in terms of more fun stuff, I saw the story a couple weeks ago, and I've been wanting to talk about a show we just had so much else to talk about. But have you seen this new speed poker at Aria in Las Vegas?
I have, because it's in our magazine, this issue.
Exactly. So, yeah. Well, thanks.
Well, you said, have you seen it? I was like, yeah, I've seen it.
But here's the idea. As a game creator, and you know, we have lots of people out here trying to create new poker games. And essentially what it is there's a table at the Aria that has two dealers at it, kind of facing each other. Players sitting around the table like they normally do, but they have two wind-off boxes in front of them. One is one stack of chips, the other is another stack of chips. And both these dealers are dealing hands to them, but they can't commingle cards, they can't commingle chips. They're actually playing two games of poker at the same time.
Yep.
And it could be two very different games, too. It could be Omaha for one and Hold'em for another one.
Yep.
And I give the guy creativity for coming up with it, and certainly, on the story in our magazine, Adam, the manager at Aria, is very excited to have it out there. Seems a little confusing for my 40-year-old mind, though. I don't know if I could follow it, but it sounds like some people that play it, it takes a little getting used to, but then they can follow it, so who knows?
To me, it sounds like the dealers are the ones that have the hardest job here. I mean, as a player, I'm getting two cards. The blue cards on the right are for this deck, the red cards on the left are for this one. And I'm just playing two hands of poker like I'm multi-tabling, which is what obviously the audience are trying to capture. But it sounds like, as a dealer, oh my God, it's like, do I interfere with what the other dealer is saying? Because the other dealer is talking to him about, it's your turn to act. And then you're like, well, it's his turn to act for me too. And who gets to act for who? You know what I mean? It sounds like the dealers themselves have to work out some sort of partnership or you know, system. But as a player, I think it would be okay. And then the other thing too is if you go broke on one stack, if the other stack, if you can borrow us from that other stack and not leave the other stack with less than a buy-in, you can do that. So you can share your chips in a way, but you have to be decimated on one side.
Right. Yeah.
But it sounds. I mean, I definitely, like you said, I definitely tip my hat to people who are trying to find different ways to capture an audience that they don't have right now but does exist, and that is a lot of online players want to play as many hands as possible, and they know they're never going to get that in a brick and mortar room. But now here you have a chance to sort of multi-table without having the multi-table. So you know, you might even get a guy to go heads up and deal four or five games, you know, with a heads up guy or something, and have two dealers dealing two each or something. You know, I think it's cool. Like you said, it could get confusing, but really, if you just have two decks and two stacks and two colors, and you're getting four cards in one and two in the other, or maybe they're the same game too. You could also just say, I want to play as many hands as Hold'em with 5-10 Hold'em that I can.
Right, yeah.
You know?
I mean, the advantage, and we talked about this kind of jokingly on the show before, after Black Friday, is there a way for us to bring the multi-table experience And I think our idea was some kind of pinwheel thing where you're at seated at eight tables and fanned out. I still think there's probably some promise in that, but
it's like Bobby Fischer when he used to have in circle or in squared with chess boards and people, and he'd just walk from board to board and same kind of thing.
So yeah, absolutely. Like everything, I hope it works out and people like it. I'm not one of these people. I read a review this morning, real quick thing. I think it was, and I'm not going to cite the writer or the organization, but you could just read it and get the sense that he went out there to see this thing fail.
Yeah.
And that was his story. Hey, there's nobody there that night. I waited 3 hours and they had three names. Okay, that's one night out of, go back three or four other times.
Exactly.
So I'm not one of those haters. I'd be curious to see the people that play this and how it works out. And what I think would be funny is it's almost like a demolition derby. What if the two dealers are dealing at the same time?
Exactly.
You think they have to practice that, back in the break room, instead of playing open face Chinese poker, they're trying to deal synchronized dealing and not hit each other's cards.
Exactly, and it's you got to worry about stepping on each other's toes, even with getting your action completed, or you hurrying the player because he's got a decision to make on the other hand, but he's got to act on the hand he has now. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, I know you're taking your time because you don't know if you should have bet on the river or folded on the river or whatever, or you need to make a call here, but you have another hand over here you got to act on too, because I got nine other players who want to play, or whatever it is. And it's going to get confusing, like you said. It is going to be confusing. As a player, I'd be fine, I think. But as a dealer and others in the hand, it'd be kind of like, oh my God, I'm waiting for this guy to act.
Well,
another hand.
It's particularly another particularly advantageous game for people that have very good attention to detail, right?
Yes.
I'm starting to think. Even when we play double flop at home in the home game, right? A fairly simple, obviously more complicated than regular limit hold'em, right?
Right.
And how many times have people got confused over the boards, or hey, I'm going for a flush on the top, and then that flush card comes in the bottom, and hey, my flush got there. Oh, it didn't. Oh, shoot.
Yeah.
And these are smart people that we play with, right? We don't have idiots in our game. And I think it's that there's that potential in this too, because it's even harder, because now you've got two separate hands and two different dealers. And I think it rewards the folks that don't have those mental lapses.
Absolutely. And I think that's the edge that people will look for when they sit down, if they know that they can handle both sides of it. Look for the player that's confused and pounce. So it'll be interesting to see if it works out. And like I said, we applaud them for trying to come up with something different to capture another audience. So we'll have to check in with them periodically and see if they are having any success with it.
All right, well, everybody's given the hotline a holiday break, which I guess is great, but I'm beginning to worry that people don't know the number, right?
Maybe.
So I'm going to do it very slowly.
Okay.
And enunciate clearly, which will make my wife happy, because I don't do that, right?
Right.
813-448-1120.
Very good.
That's our hotline number. Feel free to call. It's completely free. Leave us some great comment, question, we'll put it on the show. If you're just busting our balls about the Packers Bears game, enjoy it, but it's not going to get on the show. Go ahead and give us a call, and we'll be happy to give you some great prizes. We're working on some new swag for the new year, too, so you might want to get those calls lined up so you have a chance at that exciting swag.
Well, one thing that will make the show is the mailbag this week from Mark Carter. He says, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on the concept of the overbet. I was playing No Limit Hold'em the other day and ran into a guy employing this technique regularly. Honestly, the style of play got me out of my usual style of play. Okay, that style of play got him out of his usual style of play. He ended up making some mistakes. He said, but I have to think this comes with its own set of drawbacks. You'd often overpay to get similar results, such as in a C-bet. Obviously, when you have the best hand, it's a lot easier to get more money out of the pot. But when you run up against a better hand, I have to think it's a very costly mistake. What do you think, Scott?
I like the overbet every once in a while, if it's used judiciously. And it sounds like this guy that he's playing against uses it all the time.
Right.
And if you use it all the time, I think Mark is right. You're going to get, when you get snapped off, it's going to cost you a lot. And when you win with it, you're going to get a little bit. This is, again, this is 2 weeks in a row we talked about the Martingale system, right?
Yes.
it's very similar to that, is that you know, you're wagering a lot of money and you are going to lose a lot of money, or you're going to win a little bit of money. It's usually what's going to happen. So I think it's just a recipe for disaster doing it all the time. But yeah, I like the overbet from times. You know, again, particularly players, again, everything in poker comes down to knowing your player, your opponent. And when I'm at a table and I see somebody, you know, criticizing somebody to play, and they're talking about the math, you didn't have the odds, blah, 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 I know they are dialed in to what opponents should do, and not remembering that we're all humans and we do different things, sometimes dumb stuff at the table, right?
Right.
And against that player, I think every once in a while, putting a big overbet out there is going to be tremendous, because they're going to do what we do on the O'Malley's move and the hand of the week, and sit there and break it down and go, there's absolutely no way he can have that. If he had that, why would he bet so much? I call, boom, stacked him.
Yeah.
But for normal idiots like me, it's not going to work against me. I don't put all that thought into it. So
now, a minute ago, you said you weren't an idiot. Now you've just called yourself an idiot. So which is it?
It depends on the day.
Okay. It depends on the day.
If my wife's around, I'm an idiot. If not, then I'm a Mensa candidate.
But you're right. You know, when I first started playing cash games, I don't think it was tournaments. I remember, and it was this a decent amount of time ago. I mean, this is probably 2004. And I remember when someone did bet a lot of times they were bluffing, and you knew why I bet so much, and you call, and you know, and then once everyone caught wind of that, and it became prevalent that people were always bluffing, people always thought they were bluffing, that's when they use it to their advantage, at least in my cash games, because I can remember like always being them bluffing, and then now there's just no way you can use that as a reason anymore. You really have to know the person. So you know, I like the overbet occasionally. I don't like it as a constant technique. That's just, to me, you're never going to win enough to make it work enough for you.
Yeah. Well, again, it's like anything in poker. I mean, if you settle into a habit, it's going to be exploitable.
Yeah.
You got to keep your opponents guessing. So,
yeah.
You know. All right. Well, hey, Mark, we appreciate you sending your mailbag question, and remind the rest of our listeners to send theirs as well to podcast@antiupmagazine.com. And if we use it on the show like we did Mark's, we're going to send you something great. Like, we're going to send Mark a deck of J Design playing cards, official playing cards of AntiUp. So you can pick up your own decks in the AntiUp store at antiupstore.com.
Hey, Red Rock Casino Resort Spa in Las Vegas will host the next AntiUp Poker Tour event on January 25th with satellites beginning January 21st. Scott's going to be there, so come out, say hi to him, call him an idiot, and take your shot at making the cover of AntiUp magazine. There's also special AntiUp room rates for $89 are being offered. And we just found out that Thunder Valley Casino Resort in California has announced that it's running satellites for all AntiUp Poker Tour events. More details on all AUPT events can be found at AntiUpPokerTour.com.
And don't forget, Jonathan Little will be the pro on our February 4th AntiUp Poker Cruise out of Port Canaveral. We're past our rate guarantee deadline now, but book ASAP so we can make sure you still get on and get you a good rate. And remember, we're also sailing out of Miami, New York City, and Tampa next year. And all the details, including how you can win your way on board, at Dover Downs, Derby Lane, Tampa Bay Downs, Daytona Beach Kennel Club, and Seneca Salamanca at AntiUpCruises.com.
I'm always proud of you when you can say Seneca Salamanca without messing it up. Don't forget, we are. You can win an AntiUp Poker Cruise and a personalized AntiUp League Champions jacket at Dover Downs and Tampa Bay Downs. Visit AntiUpMagazine.com/leagues for all the details, and ask the manager of your favorite poker room to set up a league in their room for you, so you can have this great opportunity as well.
And we're looking to expand our staff. So if you live in Missouri, Oklahoma, or Canada, you can become one of our great ambassadors and apply for that great job at AntiUpMagazine.com/ambassadors.
Hey, Scott, what happened on the AntiUp news desk this week?
U.S. Senator Harry Reid has declared efforts for a federal online bill dead for 2012, but will renew his push in 2013. However, the Nevada Democrat feels as if the push has lost momentum and isn't sounding confident of success next year either.
Oh, man. That sucks.
Gotta have the Momo.
I know, and it could be one of those things where he's kind of like, you know, disguising it, saying he's not really going to do anything with it, and then
sandbag.
Boom! Yeah, sandbag. Boom, here it is, January 10th, You know, who knows? But I remember when this first was announced, I think it was the Las Vegas Journal, Review Journal, everybody like on 2 Plus 2 and Twitter, they're all like, oh man, it's dead. And they all thought like it was dead.
Yeah.
And nobody realized that the next thing the guy said was, we're going to revisit it in 2013. So I'm not giving up hope, even if he does sound less confident. But it's definitely not dead. It's just he's not going to be able to get it through in 2012 because of all this fiscal cliff and all this other stuff that's taking precedence, and there's no way he can attach it. Because no other laws or bills are being pushed through right now. There's nothing for him to attach it to.
Man, you got to have faith.
That's right.
Will Smith, Bad Boys. Great quote. I am always the perpetually optimistic part of the show, and I gotta say, really, it seems like Reed has just given up this fight. He doesn't have it in him anymore to continue, and I hope I'm wrong. I really do. It's gonna be much tougher to get a pass next year than it would have been these past couple weeks. But just reading his comments, you just feel like somebody whose dog has just been run over by a car, don't you?
Yeah, a little bit.
And there's just no optimism whatsoever in his voice. And that doesn't mean everything is pinned on him. I mean, somebody else, Joe Barton has been pushing his bill forever. Maybe a couple of other senators will pick this up and run with it. So certainly a lot to hope for in the future. But right now, man. Just doesn't seem very exciting.
Now, is Reed retiring too?
No.
So just Kyle is right.
Yeah, just Kyle. Okay. Yeah. So I'm sure he'll you know do what he can at it. But when someone says you know something has lost momentum, he's really talking about what he's talking about there. And he wasn't talking about anything else. He wasn't talking about the physical cliff or anything else. He was talking about this bill, and just didn't seem like he was very excited about prospects next year. Hope I'm wrong.
California State Senator says he plans to reintroduce a stalled online poker bill in that state before Christmas. You better get a move on. The announcement comes just weeks after the California Online Poker Association, a two-year-old lobbying group of card rooms and Indian casinos in the Golden State, said it was disbanding because legislation had not gone anywhere in the state. It's interesting.
And New Jersey, the New Jersey Assembly passed it this week. The Senate's supposed to vote on it probably by the time most of the time folks listen to this show. So I think that's going to be the next thing now that this federal bill never got anywhere right now. I think it's going to embolden these states to kind of push forward. So not ideal, but at this point, you know, if I can get online poker in Florida, I'm going to take it.
Yeah, me too.
All right, and finally, Poker Productions, the television production company that produced the NBC Heads Up Poker Championship, has announced the event will resume next year. Filming for the 64-player $20,000 buy-in event will be held in late January at Caesars Palace in Las Vegas.
I wondered about this, and I was happy that it came back, because I think the title itself is a pretty cool thing, even though it was just made for TV. But the other thing was, you know, when everything went away, they all said because there was no online money to fund it.
Right.
Now Poker Productions is getting the money somehow. And was it just because they were just scared at the beginning and it really wasn't about the online money? They were just scared because of all the Black Friday stuff, and now that everything's calmed down and they've seen that people can be made whole again and online poker is starting to bounce back, that's why they're doing it?
I have really no idea. I mean, it could be that they found some mainstream advertiser to fund it. There's lots of reasons, I guess, for it. But yeah, it is a little bit surprising that what at least was billed as a really made for online poker production is coming back without online poker. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that NBC probably thought there were some decent ratings on it, and that maybe they just figured now that it's not taboo like they thought it was after Black Friday, that they some you know calmer heads prevailed and they said we can probably sell ads for this, let's bring it back. So
well, and remember, it wasn't so much about the ads for the show, it was the buy-in. I mean, $20,000 buy-in is a pretty big deal for Heads Up, and you know, a lot of that money was paid for by online sites, you know, for their sponsored players. So there's something to be said that maybe we see some more foreign players in it this year that are still being sponsored by online sites that were willing to pay for it. And maybe it's going to be more heavy on celebrities who you know, have a lot more money and feel like ponying up their own money for it. So, and I know they're doing some satellites too, and letting some of us average Joes in. So, you know, that pays for a couple spots. So, you know, until we actually see how the final field shapes up, I don't think we can really know where the money is or isn't.
Well, you're going out there in January. Maybe we should have you go in playing this thing.
Yeah. I'm going to poke my head in there because, you know, it'd be really smart business for me to play in the Heads Up Championship during an Antioch Poker Tour event going on down the street.
Hey. You won a Heads Up title on our ship. So I trust you with $20,000 of our money.
No, I would love to play it. It's just not smart business for me to tell my client, hey, I can't be here today. I got to be down at this other casino getting on TV. So, but, you know, hey, that Red Rock event has a Heads Up event in it, and I am really looking forward to that. I hope I can make it in there.
Awesome.
Capping it to 32 players. So,
hey, we got a fresh O'Malley's move. Here we go.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we're sitting 2-5, no limit hold'em. Overextending ourselves, we've bought in for 1,000 and have lost 150. This is a pretty tough, action-heavy table, with a lot of young guns who love taking an aggressive angle and running with it, even with air. The blinds post, under the gun calls, plus one calls, plus two folds, the MP1 calls, and we're in the MP2 with the Jack of Spades, Jack of Hearts. Since there are three players already in, and still four to act behind us, we're going to make a raise. The standard for the table is 4x big blind, but we've got to account for the limpers here. We make it $35 to go. It's folded back around to the end of the gun, who calls, as does the plus one, but the MP1 folds. This pot is already huge. With roughly 110 in the pot, we see a flop of the Queen of Hearts, Queen of Clubs, Three of Clubs, and it's checked to us. Now these two knuckleheads are classic loose aggros with too much money. They both sit with north of a grand. Why do we always find ourselves covered with guys like these? This might be a pretty safe flop, but these guys love to slow play when they hit. We make it $75 to go. The under the gun folds, but the plus one calls. There's about 260 in the pot when the turn puts a third queen out there, Queen of Spades. Our opponent now counts out a bet and puts 175 into the pot. What's our move?
Here at Antioch, we love our poker movies, Chris, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Even if there's not rounders. So when Mike Weeks contacted us saying he was shopping his new poker movie to film festivals, we just had to take a look, and today Mike joins us to tell us more about Drawing Dead, the highs and lows of online poker, a documentary he directed and narrated. While including a short history of modern poker, the film deals much more with the potential addiction of online poker, framed by two contrasting stories. One of Michael Corpy, who developed a serious poker addiction that got him kicked out of two colleges, and Dusty Schmidt, who's become one of the most successful online poker players without as much of a hint of an addiction. Mike, thanks for joining us very early this morning.
Scott, Chris, thanks for having me on.
All right, so the most obvious question we always ask any filmmaker is where he got the inspiration to make the movie. So how much of that was your own roller coaster ride with online poker?
I mean, it's safe to say that I definitely experienced both sides of the story, not to the extreme of Michael getting kicked out of school and walking across the country, and not to the extreme of Dusty becoming a multimillionaire, but I think most online poker players have experienced what it's like to overdraft your account 5, 10, 15, 20 times. And also, you know, I've been on the receiving end of some pretty solid victories, so I've definitely experienced both parts of Dusty and Michael's story, and that's really where the inspiration for the film came from.
Well, Michael's story of a college student who basically hit rock bottom playing poker to excess, and then he walks from Seattle to Boston to raise awareness for problem gambling, it's definitely right. A compelling one. Did you find him before starting making the film or after?
Now, honestly, it's a random, long story. I'll give you the short version of it.
Okay.
Basically, man, I used to have a pretty hectic job. I worked at in corporate retail in Columbus, Ohio, and it was one of those jobs that was a 70 or 80 hour a week gig. I got a new job out in Portland for Adidas, actually, the footwear company, and it was like a 9 to 5. And I got home at 5 o'clock, and I had no idea what to do with myself. I mean, literally, I just kind of sat there twiddling my thumbs. So I looked through my my bucket list, and making a documentary was always on that. So yeah, man, I took a class out here. It was a 10-week class, and basically my idea for a short film was to show both sides of online poker. Because honestly, man, I got tired of watching poker on TV and seeing everybody being portrayed as this rags-to-riches story, because that's not the reality of the game. That's what happens some of the time. It's not what happens most of the time.
Right.
So that was the initial motivation for the short. I started looking for the winner and the loser, for lack of a better word. And I started actually going to Gamblers Anonymous meetings. I was trying to look for a guy with a compelling story that, you know, had something to do with poker or online poker. But the problem was that everybody at those meetings, I mean, it was so far beyond what I was looking for. I mean, these people had serious problems. I mean, they were addicted to crack. They couldn't read. They were alcoholics. They were addicted to scratch-offs. It was way too extreme. I wanted a guy that people could relate to, you know? So I met up with this group of activists for problem gambling, and they told me about this kid named Michael that was walking across the country. So I reached out to him on his blog. He said yes, and next thing I know it, I was on a plane to the middle of nowhere, Union, Missouri, which is like, it's like 3 hours outside of St. Louis. It's literally the middle of nowhere.
Wow.
So that's how I met Michael.
Wow.
Wow, yeah, and there were some great, the interviews with him were great, because you really could tell you were out in the middle of nowhere. I had no idea it was Missouri, but you could tell it was nowhere that you purposely tried to go. Yeah. To find him. Yep. Well, Dusty Schmidt was just a perfect contrast to Michael, as someone who's made millions of dollars holed up in his home playing online poker without it ever becoming a problem for him. What prompted you to cast him as the flip side of online poker?
So, you know, trying to find the winner, I basically put out an ad on Craigslist. I hung flyers in poker rooms around the Portland area, and I interviewed a couple people, but Dusty was always the pinnacle. He was the only big name guy that I knew that lived in the Portland area. I actually reached out to him on Facebook, and, you know, he blew me off, and I can't blame him. Who am I? I'm this, you know, 29-year-old kid at the time that has never made a movie before in his entire life, working on what was essentially a class project. So he blew me off. So, you know, I had Michael, but I still didn't have the contrast, so the film was incomplete. I guess as luck would have it, I was in my local poker room, the Encore Club, which is actually where I found your guys' magazine and why I decided to reach out to you. I was playing like a $30 tournament, no limit tournament, and lo and behold, I'm sitting across from Dusty. he was there with his wife, basically, just, you know, having fun on a Friday night, throwing around $30, playing low stakes. So, you know, I called him out. I was like, Dusty. And he looked at me like, you know who I am? And yeah, I'm Mike. I'm the filmmaker, so on and so forth. And we started chatting it up over a couple hands, and he agreed to do the interview. So that's how I got Dusty.
Well, what I really like about your story is that you did make the effort to tell both sides of it, and that it wasn't just this. Because, you know, as a journalist, that's what people are supposed to do. But as documentarians, a lot of people don't do that. They just want to tell a story.
Right.
And they'll just tell that one end of it, and then you're like, yeah, but what about all this other stuff that could, you know, you tried to show that, hey, it's not just this depressing thing or whatever. No, it's also something that people can flourish at. And I like that you balance it that way.
Yeah, you know, and the reason I didn't like try to do that, really, it's just that's a reflection of my experience of the poker world and everybody else I know. You know, Dusty and Michael are extreme cases. And even when you watch poker on TV, those are the extreme cases. I wanted to show an honest perspective of what it's like in the poker world.
Well, you know, Dusty himself never really developed an addiction, obviously. But you did highlight something that many of us have seen with other online phenoms who were forced to take a break because of Black Friday. Healthier, happier, spending more time on other pursuits, with their families, that kind of thing. In your opinion, is there a danger to online poker, even for players who aren't addicted to it?
Yeah, I mean, the addiction word is, it's a funny word, right? Because there's a tip in poker, which many people would say that's just a form of addiction, which I tend to agree. I can't see anybody that plays poker for a living, or as much as Dusty or Michael or I did, not experience some form of addiction. I think that what separates people is how they deal with that addiction. I definitely think Dusty learned out how to manage his addiction with the game, and he turned it into a success, you know. But I mean, the main question is, like, is being a professional online poker harmful in any way, right?
Right.
And it just depends who you ask, because if you were to ask me if I wanted to spend my entire life in front of a computer screen looking at digital cards, I'd say no. You know, I dabble with that a little bit, and it wasn't a rewarding lifestyle. You know, if I had a couple million dollars in my bank account, maybe I could justify it. But I think at the end of the day, you know, when you're 70 years old, and if you spent 30 years of your life staring at a computer screen, you'd have a lot of regret. But I don't think that just applies to online poker. I mean, I think there's a lot of other careers out there that you could say the same thing about. I mean, the stock market, being a stockbroker, is essentially, you know, a glorified online poker player. There's lots of people that sit in cubicles every day for 40 years that don't have a very rewarding lifestyle. So, you know, I don't think that online poker should be the goal for a college kid. I don't think that should be black your choice. I think it's a fun hobby. I think it's a fun game. But I think people should be aware of the potential risks and the reality of becoming a millionaire.
Well, one of the things that really jumped at me in the movie, Mike, and by far the starkest evidence of the difference between Michael and Dusty, is when in the movie you rattled off the 10 questions that psychologists ask patients who are at risk of pathological gaming, and anyone who answers yes to 7 or more is diagnosed, and Dusty answered yes to only 1, while Michael answered yes to all 10. Were you all at all surprised when you learned that?
Yeah, I was. I expected Dusty to answer yes to more of them, but it's funny. I mean, in the world of online poker, you know, when I asked Dusty or Michael those questions, can totally change the answer to those. You know, if I'm asking Dusty those questions when he's, you know, has $4 million in the bank account and he's sponsored by poker sites, you know, it's clear that he has it under control. But if I asked him that, you know, 5 or 6 years ago when he was just getting started with the game and when he had his checking account was on 0, he might have answered differently. Same thing you could say for Michael. You know, if you asked Michael when he was having success with the game, I don't know if he would have answered the same way. So it's funny. I mean, in the online poker world, like, how good you are as a player, a lot of times depends on just when you ask that question.
Yeah, very good point.
One of the things I often wondered about with Michael's story, and when he, you know, he did this walk across the country to raise awareness, but I just have to wonder what was his reasoning, and I understand that maybe he's trying to do something good for people, but why is it that he thinks walking across the country is going to raise awareness for it's just, it seemed to me that there was no real clear reason for him to do it other than he wanted to prove to his father that he could do something. I don't know, but I wondered if he was really doing it for the right reasons.
I mean, that's a fair question, and I definitely have the same question going out there. You know, how is a walk across the country going to change anything? But you know, I think initially the purpose of the walk was to raise awareness for problem gambling. But I think the underlying reason for him walking was the guy just needed a break.
Yeah.
He needed a change in his life, and he needed to do something different in order to do that change. And, you know, if he's going to bring awareness to a problem that, you know, 4% of the population struggles with, good for him. You know, I have a ton of admiration for the guy. I know he's been through a lot, and I know there's a lot of people who have gone through something similar but just don't have the balls to share it, don't have the guts to, you know, actually pull the trigger and quit. So yeah, to answer your question, you know, is walking across the country gonna change the world for problem gamblers? Maybe, maybe not. But I'll tell you one thing, he's doing a lot more for problem gambling than a lot of other people I know. So I give him respect for that.
Yeah, very good point. You know, another part of the movie that kind of stuck me was the discussion of how a gambling addiction differs from other addictions. And, you know, as the movie points out, it's probably really obvious, but it wasn't until watching your film. Most of these other addictions, like alcohol or drugs, the body has a way of shutting down eventually when you get really past it. But mm-hmm. but not so with gambling, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, going into it. So in the film, I talked to a bunch of specialists in problem gambling, psychologists, neurologists, and that was the main question that I honestly had going into it. I honestly didn't know. When I looked at comparing gambling addiction to heroin addiction, for example, you know, I'm thinking, one, there's literally, you're sticking needle in your arm, and in your body. How in the hell can that be any way in the same frame as somebody looking at a piece of paper with a number on it? Right. But what it comes down to is it's they're one and the same. I mean, it's all about what the trigger is, right? So the trigger for heroin is the actual chemical, but the trigger for gambling is the actual behavior. So the brain responds the exact same way to both. They just have different stimuli. And that was one of the most interesting things I found while taking on this project.
You know, I thought that the way you made this movie, and it was very, very creative, and you know, you interlaced old footage, animation, some cool graphics. And then, you know, the fact that you weren't even a film student, and what made you get into the documentary? I know you talked about going to this class for it and stuff, but why didn't you try a different way of telling a story like this? Was it just this medium that really attracted you to it, or was there some other reason?
Yeah, to be honest with you, I'm a pretty stubborn guy.
Okay.
What other way to prove a point than making a movie? Really. I'm a documentary fan. I love that form of argument because it truly allows you to get all the facts and all the opinions together in one place and tell a compelling argument in 60 and 90 minutes. So that's, you know, I've always been a fan of documentaries, and I've always been a poker player, so combining the two seemed natural. But the main thing, so that's essentially why the short came about. How the full length came about was a, you know, completely different story. Do you want me to elaborate on that at
sure,
all?
Sure, absolutely.
So I did the short, and you can find it on YouTube still. It's Drawing Dead Poker Documentary. Just search for it; it'll pop up. And I showed it at a local theater here called Mission Theater, and literally the date that it was shown was April 16th, 2011.
Oh my
God! So Black Friday just happened the day before, and I had this small little film project that was talking exactly about online poker. So my topic was in the headlines. It was luck, you know. It was absolute luck. So I put the film online on YouTube, and you know, the first day I got like 20 views. The next day I got 30 views. I basically just wanted to share it with my friends and family and say, hey, you know, I did this thing. It's pretty cool. Check it out. Then one day I got like 1,400 views, and then the next day I got another 1,400 views, and they just started to pile up. Well, on YouTube you can actually see like where the views come from, and it turns out this French poker site called like clubpoker.net found it randomly on YouTube and wrote an article about it. When they wrote an article about it, another French poker site did. When they did, a UK site wrote an article about it, and it just started bouncing all over Europe. And before you know it, I had like 100,000 views, and it was at that point where I was like, you know what? If I'm ever going to make a big boy documentary, if I'm ever going to take a risk on this, this is the topic, this is the film, and this is the time. So I did a Kickstarter campaign, and it worked.
Yeah, actually, it leads right into our next question. You know, I noticed at the end of the movie you raised the seed money for this through Kickstarter.com. So tell our listeners a little bit about what Kickstarter.com is and how this process worked for you.
Yeah, absolutely. So Kickstarter.com is basically a website where you can fund creative projects. So it's mostly utilized by filmmakers, musicians, new products. Basically, people put together a pitch video and put it out on the internet, and people contribute money if they want to see that project come to life. So that's basically what I did. I put up a 5-minute video, and I raised, I don't know, like $4,000 or $5,000 or something like that, which in retrospect wasn't nearly enough to finish the film, but it was enough.
So it's pretty much like a Shark Tank for... you know, the other thing I wanted to mention too is we have a lot of fans for this show at the Encore Club, and so I was kind of impressed to actually see it in the film, and that's the room that you play in more often than others, right?
Yeah. John and Sean over there, actually, they let me film quite a few of the scenes over at the Encore Club. I was actually just there yesterday. Took down the 4 o'clock. No big deal. That's a great. It's the best poker room I've ever been to, honestly, and it's definitely the best poker room in Portland. So, was very thankful those guys let me shoot there.
Excellent.
Did this documentary, as you saw Mike's story, did it scare you at all for yourself or for others? I mean, I'm not going to lie, it was a depressing story. I mean, yeah. It really was. I mean, the entire story is well rounded, and you know the hard work you put in. I mean, all documentaries aren't, you know, fluff and puff. I mean, this is some solid stuff. Did it make you nervous at all about your own situation? Did it make you worry at all?
That's a good question. I mean, I worry as much about becoming Michael as I do about becoming Dusty. But obviously, it's more realistic to be Michael.
Right.
I think most people draw the line. I don't think most people steal. We'll you know, end up stealing to fund their gambling habit. But I don't know. I think that's a lot more realistic and a lot more prevalent than people becoming millionaires. So it didn't worry me as much as it reminded me of my past. It reminded me of the 6 months of my life where I was unemployed and I relied on online poker. And, you know, if I had a bad day at online poker, I had a horrible day in general.
Right.
Just reminded me how, you know, that lifestyle wasn't for me. But it's funny because, you know, most people, when you ask about poker, you know, in the long run, are you up or down? They'll say up because they don't remember losses. I really am one of the guys that is up in the long term. The reason I decided to stop playing online, aside from Black Friday, but I actually stopped playing online before that, was just the convenience of it. You know, I mean, it's like a video game. Like, I'm not video game guy. I was growing up, but the one thing I learned growing up playing video games every day after school was there is nothing less productive you can do.
Come on, it improves hand-eye coordination. That's got to be something.
Michael, we did a show on addiction several years ago. I don't know if you even remember that, Chris.
It was a long time ago.
And, some of the feedback was, hey, thanks for the buzzkills, guys. I guess it kind of reminded me, watching a movie kind of reminded me of that for me, the reason of doing that show, and I'm curious whether this is part of the reason for you doing the movie, isn't so much the worry of our listeners or your viewers developing a dangerous addiction, which is fairly small. I think you said 4% in the movie, right?
Considered pathological gamblers, that doesn't mean that only 4% of people are addicted to poker. They're considered pathological. They have pathological gambling disorder.
Right. I think, to me, the bigger point was there are a much, much higher percentage of players that aren't addicted, but it is having overindulging in it is having an effect on their life. And it's a reminder of trying to be a little bit more balanced. And, we talked a little bit about this at the beginning of the interview. You know, one of our columnists, you know, I've talked to him a couple times after Black Friday. He thought, you know, hey, my world is over without Black Friday. And now, a little bit more than a year later, he's like, you know what? I'm having a great time now. It forced me to reassess my priorities. So I wonder how much of that was part of it. I mean, speaking to quote unquote normal players about just keeping their life in balance with this game.
Honestly, man, I mean, that is literally the whole purpose of the film. I mean, you guys are one of the few people that have seen the full length, and you'll know the whole moral is don't waste your talent. You know, Michael has an amazing talent. He plays the violin better than anybody I've ever heard in my entire life. And that's one of the focal points of the story, is that, you know, playing poker for him took away from his true love, which was music. You know, and Dusty, I mean, Dusty is an amazing golfer, And while he experienced a lot of success with online poker, his number one dream was playing on the PGA Tour.
Yeah.
So that's really what the film is about. And, I mean, you guys have seen the film as well, and you'll know that this isn't a cry to outlaw poker. This is actually a pro poker movie. This is, in my opinion, one of the most solid cases for poker legalization compared to anything else that I've seen, at least. But it's a realistic argument. It says, look, guys, this is the game. This is the dangers. This is the reality of being a millionaire. Make your choices wisely. But if we're going to allow people to do it, it needs to be responsible. You know, the government needs to put regulations in place to make sure that people playing online, you know, have the avenues they need in case they do fall into that 4%. So really, this movie is a pro-poker movie. It's just a realistic viewpoint of the actual poker world.
You know, and I agree with you, too, because when you think about, and I know I've thought about how many times where I had a bad beat online and then just instantly went to my account and deposited more money in because I wanted to get that money back. And I thought, God, you know, if I was playing a home game,
that wouldn't happen.
I'd have to go home. Or if I was playing at the casino, I'd have to walk all the way to the ATM and then think about paying the fee for the ATM. And I'm cheap, so I probably wouldn't want to do that. So I'd probably go broke. And then I think you're right. I think when online poker does get regulated, there is going to be some sort of, hey, you know, you need to set a limit for yourself. Here's what the limit's going to be. And then you have to live up to it. I think that might, I don't know if it'll guaranteed to be part of every site, but I know it's probably going to be an option, and that'll help people do it. But
yeah, I mean, the whole point of the movie is it's up to the individual to make responsible choices with their life, but it's up for the government if they're gonna offer something that has potential dangers to make people aware of those dangers.
Right. Well, you know, you're working to get the movie to add to the film festivals, as we mentioned earlier, and that's your ultimate goal of having a distribution deal. Can you give us an update on your progress and where our listeners can see even a snippet of the movie before it makes it to a theater near them?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, last night while I was at the Encore Club, I got my first film festival acceptance, which was
excellent.
Nice.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this has been a huge project for me, and, you know, I have a normal 9-to-5. This has all been done on the side. So, you know, the final validation to me was, as a no-name filmmaker who's never done anything with film in his life, was getting into the film festival. So last night, I got accepted to the Thin Line Documentary Film Festival, which is outside of Dallas, Texas. So that, as of right now, is going to be the world premiere of the film.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I bought everybody a round of drinks. And,
and when's that festival going to be?
The festival dates is from February 8th. To the 18th. I don't know the exact screening date yet. We're still working out those details, but the best way for listeners to keep up with the film and figure out if it's going to play in a festival of their area, or to figure out if it gets a distribution deal or when it goes on iTunes, so on and so forth, is to follow my Facebook page. So just go to facebook.com and it's like /drawingdeadpokerdoc. And that's really the best way to keep up with the progress of the film.
Very good. Congratulations, too. That's fantastic news.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Excellent. We got a lot of listeners in Dallas, too, so hopefully they'll come out and meet you there and enjoy the movie. And again, Mike, we appreciate you getting up way too early to join us. Incredible story of getting the movie made and a great film. And I wish you the best of luck.
All right. Thanks a lot, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mike. Nice job.
This is Lee Childs, 2007 main event, 7th place finisher, and you are listening to Annie Up.
All right, we're going international again this week, Chris, on the hand of the week.
Woohoo!
Oh, coming from Glasgow, Scotland.
Wow.
Is that actually how you pronounce it? You know, because again, I never know these cities. You know. Seems like it should be Glasgow.
You know, the last time I suggested something, I got lambasted by the person that I suggested it to. So, whatever. Just say it's from Scotland. It's from your homeland.
All right, well, I wish I could say that, but then he makes it specific to say, hey, there is a limited poker scene in Glasgow. So I'm going to just assume I'm pronouncing it right?
I don't know. I would say Glasgow, but I don't want to say that.
Glasgow?
Yeah, I would say Gow. Like Pygow.
All right, but at least it's not like it's
glacial there.
Frankenstein.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what you like it, right? all right, so Glasgow, there are three casinos that run one tournament a day. He says roughly around £40 buy-in, and one or two cash tables of 1-2 no limit, but only after late at night. So he doesn't have a lot of options, right?
Right.
Okay, so this hand actually comes from the cash game, not a tournament. It's a 1-2 no limit hold'em. Okay. Again, pounds here, so this is like probably mortgage payments for us.
Yeah.
1-2 pound, no limit hold'em. And he says our hero here, which is Jason, says that this hand caused all the players at the table who had been quiet to protest and make comments on how badly the hand was played.
Great.
That is so unusual, he thought he would share it. So
kind of love that going into this.
Yeah, not going to be wearing your garden variety hands. All right, table is seven-handed. Our hero had bought in for 80 pounds and was up 230 now. He didn't say he ran it up. He just has 230, so lay off him, all right?
Wow.
He says it was the biggest stack at the table, although all the other players were between 100 and 150. Everyone on the table seemed reasonable. Standard was 4X big blind. No one was playing anything to show down other than suited connectors or pocket pairs. That's interesting.
Wow.
Not many hands went to showdown, though, as people were taking down, so no one was called on a bluff to his recollection. So maybe they're playing some variety of other hands that just weren't shown.
Right, right. All right,
he's on the button. There were two lippers when it gets to him, and he has the ace of spades, queen of spades.
Nice. Well, he told me that standard raise was 4X, but he's got a couple of limpers.
Yep.
So I would make it like 6, 7X here. So 14, 12, 14-ish maybe. So, yeah, something like that. Maybe 15 pounds. Just throw 15 pounds out there and collapse the table because that's pretty heavy, 15 pounds to throw on a table. But 15 pounds probably is what I'd make it.
What weighs more, a pound of feathers or a pound of cannonballs? Here's what I think is funny about this is when I play 1-2 no limit, I don't play it very often. Because I hate it, the devil's game, right?
Right.
I always open for 10. Seeing 6 just seems almost like offensive, even though in a tournament I would do 3X or 2.5X or 4X or something around there.
Yeah.
But it just seems like, I don't know, seems like I need to make a 10 in 1-2. And most of the games I play in, it seems to be that's kind of the standard one.
I agree with that.
So here's the thing, if we got a couple limpers, I'm thinking probably at least 15 here, maybe 20.
Yeah, I said. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I said 15. Because really, if you were going to make it 10, which is only two more than what the standard is at this table anyway, 10, if you're going to make it 10, then it's two limpers. You just add their calls to that. So it'd be 14 roughly anyway. So 15 to 20 makes sense. I don't know about 20 because that's doubling what you would normally raise to. But I agree with that. About 15 or so, it seems right to me.
But the other thing is, I really don't like anything less than ace-king now. I keep talking about this, I think. And we got another hand that'll be on a show a little bit later, I think. But I really, that's the big leak of my game, is playing these hands that are not ace-king.
Yes.
There hasn't been raised, so it's a little different.
I do recall you in a sit-and-go at Derby Lane in the small blind folding ace-queen to, like, what was apparently, like, a minimum raise or something in three callers. But you folded ace-queen, and I almost fell over.
Well, because it gets you in trouble, I think. Now,
I agree.
So it's 190 times better, right?
Exactly.
And no one had raised either, which is a little different. If it's a raised pot, then I'm definitely, I should say definitely, but I'm really looking for a reason to stay in at that point. But it's limped here, so I think I can make a compelling case that I might just limp along and then hope for a nice flop, and if not, it costs me 2 pounds.
Well, the other thing you have to recall here is that you are the button, so mm-hmm. you have position the whole way through, and I like knowing that not only do I have position, but I've also taken control of the hand. I like both of those things. Nice. So I think you may be able to try making a compelling case for that, but I really think in this case, no one has shown any strength. People seem to be pretty ABC at this table. I need to thin the field and just continuation bet and take it down, and I have to feel a raise is the best move here.
All right, I totally agree. Okay. I was just fine.
Yeah, you like to do that.
But no, I mean, if somebody told me that he went, I'm like, all right. It just depends how you play it afterwards.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so our hero raises it to 12 pounds.
It could be a little more net.
Small blind folds, big blind calls, and we get another caller. So we're three-handed to the flop.
Okay, we're in position, so this is good.
I'm sorry, it says the cutoff call. So big blind cutoff and us. That's
okay.
The position.
Okay.
And the flop comes ace of hearts, queen of hearts, tray of spades.
Love that.
He says, top two, the obvious flush draw, and I have no idea the range of players I'm up against. Big Blind is first to act. He has around 140 pounds and makes it $12. Bets 12, I'm sorry, 12 pounds into the 39-pound pot. 39-pound pot. That sounds funny. The cutoff has around 98 pounds and calls. So now it's on us facing a 12-pound bet with top two.
Well, I'm definitely raising. And here's why. So many cards on that turn will make us want to just throw up. One. Two, we have a guy in the middle.
Do you throw up in your mouth, or do you actually projectile it?
It depends on the day. If I'm an idiot, I do it on the table. If I'm not an idiot, I swallow it. So,
I was confused by those people. I threw up a little bit in my mouth. Well, don't throw it up in your mouth. Find some place to get rid of it. It's gross.
So my second point is the caller. The caller tells me that he could be on a draw, and I'm not going to let this guy hit his hand for 12 pounds.
Exactly.
And I have top two. I got to think that someone limped with a small suited ace, and maybe somebody limped with threes here, and they got a set, and that could be the second guy. Could be the first guy, I don't know, but I'm gonna find out, and I'm gonna raise it here. I'm gonna make it like 50 or 60 to go. There's no way that I'm just calling, and I'm certainly not folding. A call, I think, is the worst thing you could do. Fold is pretty bad, but not raising is it's just a mistake, I think. So I'm gonna make it like 50 or 60 to go, I think.
Yeah, there's so many scenarios here that just make sense for us to have both these opponents crushed, and let's, you know. I mean, I think the most likely one is this is a weak ace on this guy, just hoping that we had a small pair or something like that.
Yeah.
And the other guy's on a draw, and you're right. We make it big, and we take it down, and I'm happy with that. Yeah. And if not, maybe they...
Think about the turn cards. Yeah. I mean, really, think about any four, any five, any heart, any jack, any king, any ten. All those cards just make you just want to quit playing poker forever. Right. So at that point, you know, that's a lot of cards to dodge on that turn, knowing that you probably are safe. So let's just take this pot down now. It's pretty decent. And if we get a caller, then we know a little more about their hand. Because I think a call again tells me they're not just drawing, you know, unless they're just completely reckless, which I haven't at all gotten from the impression of what he said earlier in the email. So I think we need to raise to like 60 or 70. What did I say? 50 or 60? 50 or 60?
Either one.
Yeah. Yeah, somewhere around there.
All right, so our hero says, this puts me in the spot where I reckon one guy probably has an ace, possibly both, but unlikely. More likely one ace and one flush draw or straight draw. So we're all on the same page here, I think. I want to figure out where I am, so I raise an extra 20 pounds. So it makes it 32 to go.
That's not enough.
Definitely not enough because you got two callers.
Oh, yeah, no. Definitely not enough. But just think about it. If you're a drawing to something and the first guy calls and you're the second guy, which is what we thought could be the second guy's drawing, mm-hmm. think about how much money's in that pot now for only 20 bucks. You know, you're definitely getting the right odds, especially implied, to try to make your hand now. So that's definitely not enough. You need to make it so that they're making a mistake by calling.
Exactly. Absolutely. All right, well, still three players. The pot is now 174 pounds, and the turn brings the seven of club, making the board ace of hearts, queen of hearts, tray of spades, seven of club. So we dodge a bullet there, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's a real good card, actually.
And he says, I figure if top two was good, it still is good, and this is a total blank. And so the big blind opens for 20 pounds into the 174-pound pot, and calls. So it's back to us.
Wow, that's weird. That is weird, especially since we raised. But we didn't raise enough, so maybe they thought that was fishy. I don't know, but wow, to bet into us again. Wow.
See, now we're going to kind of get an information now, and I don't know what the information is, but we're getting it, right? I still think this guy, the second guy, sounds like he's still on a draw, and for an extra 20 bucks now in this massive pot, why not, right?
Wow.
But we really don't know. I mean, we could be up against still a set of trays makes sense here.
Man.
Actually, any set. Actually, well, not any set. But a set of trays makes a lot of sense. It could be ace tray still. And we really don't know now. But I mean, this guy, the big blind, has felt comfortable enough with our weakish rays to still fire again, and really small too, right?
Yes, very small. Here's what I'm going to go on a limb here and say: we're still ahead, and that we were always ahead.
I think so. Okay.
And the reason why I'm going to do this is because I really feel like if I had 3-3 in this hand and I was the cutoff or the big blind guy, when our hero raises our initial bet after that flop, I have every inkling to now re-raise, hoping he has ace king or ace queen, and that I'd get this guy in the middle out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if I'm not re-raising and protecting my set of threes now, I don't have a set of threes.
Good point. Absolutely. I like that.
So I'm going to go with the fact that we have the best hand, and I'm just going to raise all in now.
And maybe he's on the draw, too.
Yeah, and that's true, too, that he's trying a defensive bet, setting the price. Exactly. So I'm going to raise all in here and hope that I'm right. And if I'm wrong, I may still have outs. You know, an ace or a queen would still give me a better full house than the pocket three. So I think I'm going to go all in and really force these guys to come to a decision. Because we were the pre-flop aggressor. We're telling them we have a set of aces, ace-queen, even ace-king, which is kind of tough to be that aggressive with. But if your reads are right, I would do it with ace-king. So I'm going to shove here.
Very interesting. Yeah. All right. Our hero says he's going to stick to the plan and raises an additional 100 pounds.
Yeah, so that's about right, because that'll probably put these guys all in anyway, or close to it. So I agree with that.
Yeah, it actually does put everybody all in, because the big blind shoves his last 88 pounds, and the cutoff shoves his last 66 pounds, and we're all in.
Oh, my God.
A 456-pound pot.
Wow, that's heavy.
Got to think we might have made a mistake here. If not, I want to play this game all the time. I'm going to come to Scotland.
Well, that's tomorrow. Scary they both called. I'm hoping that they have, like, aces up and a draw, which would be a huge mistake if they had a draw. But I'm hoping for aces up or even ace king, but that would seem kind of weird they didn't raise with a preflop, so I don't think they have that. But that's a huge pot. That's like a quarter ton right there.
Quarter ton, absolutely, yeah.
That's a lot of money.
Put that in the back of a Ford F-150.
This show not sponsored by Ford Motor Company.
All right, so we have showdown here with the last card to come. The big blind has the ace of diamonds. Wait for it. Deuce of diamonds. Drawing completely dead.
Oh, my God. Ace, deuce? This was the blind guy? Oh, my. And he keeps betting out and calling raises. Wow.
The cutoff has the ace of clubs. Wait for it. Ten of clubs. He'll also be drawing completely dead.
Wow.
And of course, we don't get a river card here, but I guess it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter, right?
So you win the pot, and the rest of the table are furious at such a poor hand resulting in such a decent win. I will never figure out how a guy can call all in with just an ace on that board, but a win is a win, so why complain? Definitely not complaining. Like I said, if I could fly to Scotland for 456 pounds, I would.
Wow.
That's insane, isn't it?
I got to tell you, a lot of things come out of this hand. One, the rarity that the case ace comes with three players with aces in their hands.
Yes.
Two, that someone with an ace and a horrible kicker could not only call the raise preflop, but then call the re-raise after calling a bet after the flop on that board, and then to stick around again for all in. How could you think you're ahead with ace deuce or ace ten there, given the action the entire way?
You know, I think this is one of those situations where people feel like they're pot committed, but they're not.
Yeah, that's a good point too. It could be.
Oh, none of them should have gotten there.
No way.
But then you just got to think at this point. I mean, I've folded like nut straights in Omaha.
Yeah.
Worried about a baby flush, you know?
Oh, yeah, me too.
This is ace weak kicker. With all this action, I just can't imagine that you're good.
And how do they imagine it? How do they come to that? How does the ace 10, after the re-raise of the flop, not think, okay, this guy's got to have like ace queen or ace king or even ace jack, and my kicker's no good. But then after that, to call the 20 on the flop on the turn, and then the re-raise with just an ace. And, you know, and a 10 kicker. The ace deuce, too. Oh, my God, that's just crazy. But on top of that, the ace 10 has to be whipsawed within that, and he should have gotten out. But the ace deuce to think that, and to keep betting into us when we're raising? Does he really think his aces are that good? Oh, man, I'd love to be in that game.
Yeah, I mean, oh, boy. I mean, the big blind here, again, I mean, he was trying to set his price. The problem was the price wasn't set.
Right.
He felt like his hand ended up being four times better than it really was. You know, I can kind of see him keep firing 20 and hopefully that he hits a deuce or something and catches us and not letting somebody take charge. But once we shove, all right, jigs up. Now this guy with the ace 10, he calls the $20 bet on the turn with 66 left.
Yeah.
That's gotta be, hey, if I'm gonna be in, I'm gonna be in now. I mean, at that point, let me put the pressure on everyone else, right?
And the other thing I want to make a point about the ace deuce was, even if the ace deuce thought Jason was bluffing, he's got a guy acting after him that's calling everything too.
Right. Exactly.
And how much, that's the old edict is, it's easier to bluff one person than it is to bluff two. And so even if that guy is bluffing and you catch him in a bluff, yay, you beat Jason in the hand. But you got the guy next to you who clearly isn't bluffing. He's calling. So how?
And that's what makes this amazing, too, if you think about this, right? So the guy is trying to – he might think that he has Jason beat, right? Which
right.
is plausible. But he has to be able to bet enough – to get the draw out, which it always seems the guy in the middle, a draw is the only thing that made sense to me, I think.
Yeah.
And if you're betting $20 into a 174, or I mean, sorry, 20 pounds into a 174 pound pot, you're never going to get a draw to fold there. So you're playing against two players where you need to make two different size bets in order to win.
Yeah.
And you can't do that. That's a problem.
Man. And this is like the equivalent of a 2-5 game here, as far as the limit. So, I mean, are there 2-5 players like that out there that are that bad in our area? Because I'm going to start playing that game a little more often then, if that's true. I mean, really, that's a 2-5 game, really.
Yeah.
Maybe even more. Maybe even like a 3-6 type of no-limit game, almost, for the conversion. Wow.
Yeah, but they probably don't have anything smaller than that. So, I mean, you got to think about it. That's their one.
That's true, too.
But still.
The
other thing, too, is he mentions, hey, everybody was talking about how bad this plan was played. So it does seem like it's an anomaly. So I just called my travel agent and told him to cancel. So.
Yeah. If they're handling it once in a while, it's not worth the trip.
but I will say, if anybody listening to the show put these two opponents on 2-week aces, I'm not going to believe you. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You're bluffing.
Yeah,
there's just no way. Again, it's just an illustration of how difficult this game can be. I mean, we really were curious as to whether we were behind here, and we were never behind.
Well, we never actually got to it, but I was putting someone on a suited ace, and I thought maybe it could have been ace tray. That was the only thing I was thinking of. It could have been ace tray. Other than that, but ace deuce and ace 10? Not a chance. I was betting that the guy had hearts in the cutoff and the big blind had ace tray, and that's why he could bet into us. But we never really got to that part. But that was the only hands that I could think made sense to me that where they would have limped and then played it. Other than that, maybe pocket threes could have possibly. But again, I came up with a reason why pocket threes probably wouldn't have worked on the turn there. So or on the flop, actually, after the raise of our hero. I think he would have raised again, knowing that he had somebody on the hook with ace-king or ace-queen. So I really think that ace-tray was the only hand that made sense there to me for that guy, and it didn't even amount to that. So sad.
Crazy. All right. Well, Jason, not that you need anything else after that amazingly gift from players, but you are going to get something else. We are going to send you a download of the Chinese 13-card poker app for Apple products from Smapsoft. Don't have to be a winner and enjoy this great app. You can download it yourself by visiting the iTunes store. And remember to send your hands of the week to podcast@antiupmagazine.com.
I want to thank Mike Weeks for joining us today. His movie, Drawing Dead, The Highs and Lows of Online Poker, is really a very, very somber look at on one side of online poker. You guys should really check it out if you can. And it's a really balanced story as well. So I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables. We'll
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.